From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. For 14 years, Andrea Seabrook covered the United States Congress for NPR, and now she won't. Frustrated with partisan gridlock and the daily competitive imperative for soundbites over substance, Seabrook has chucked her job to run a project called Decode DC, a website she intends to devote to depth, substance, context, and all the other journalistic ideals obscured by the obsession on the day's scripted talking points. She gave an interview to the website Politico this week in which she outlined her reasons for calling it quits, and some of those reasons are just horrifying. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So if I understand this correctly, you're mad as hell and you're just not going to take it anymore.
Yes, you could say it that way.
I suppose the most attention-grabbing line was being lied to every day.
Yeah.
Who's lying to you about what and why?
Well, when I say I'm lied to, this is not a situation where there's yellow cake uranium kind of lies. The lies that I'm talking about are just the complete and total disingenuousness of almost everything that's said all day long in the U.S. Capitol.
Can you give me an example of a story that you filed where you just wanted to, you know, go home and shower afterwards?
When the Republicans first regained power in the House of Representatives at the start of 2011, we could see this fiscal wreck that was coming at us. And in the very first stories of 2011, I started to describe this wreck coming, and every cut, every piece of audio, every quote I got from lawmakers, it was just nothing. There's this quote from Eric Cantor, the majority leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives.
Republicans today, we're hitting the floor with a first big step towards trying to get our fiscal house in order by delivering on our commitment to cut more than $100 billion from the deficit this fiscal year.
There are a lot of ways you can dissect this statement from Cantor. But the biggie there is that the $100 billion number that he's giving is only real if you compare the Republican budget to the budget that President Obama had put forward the year before, a budget that was never enacted, that the Republicans never would have considered real in the first place, and yet they're measuring their own achievement by someone else's yardstick because it makes them look better. Let me say, Bob, that it takes two to tango here. In the same story, at the beginning of the Republican-controlled Congress, there is a piece of tape of Nancy Pelosi with a very short soundbite saying,
"When it comes to health and education, Republicans put women and children last."
It is a scathing repudiation of real beliefs that conservatives hold to call it like that. And it does not advance the debate any more than messing around with numbers does.
You've described yourself and your colleagues as having colluded in what is essentially an ongoing masquerade. How have you done that?
By covering what politicians say all day, every day, rather than what they don't say. As journalists, walking into a situation where we know it's political theater, and then recording those words and playing them back to the American people as if they were news, plays into the game that they're playing. As a journalist, when you walk into that and pretend that it's a functioning system, or at least decide you're going to cover it as such, it plays right in. It allows those lawmakers to use manipulative language, stretched truths, untruths, to communicate through you to their constituents and to the American people. I think the only way to stop colluding with them is to step back and start covering the place from the point of view that it is dysfunctional. It is broken.
Andrea, you don't work for cable news, where pyrotechnics make for good TV, even if it harms the legislative process. You work for NPR, which presumably has no incentive to play this game. Over your 14 years, what have your editors said when you express frustration at the pointlessness of it all?
Well, I want to rush to say that everything that I have learned about being a journalist has come from the amazing editors, producers, and other reporters on the Washington desk at NPR. The reality of that newsroom is that it is very much cash-strapped compared to any other newsroom in Washington, pretty much. And it is about as much as NPR is able to do to cover what is considered the daily news and have insightful features as often as they can get them on. As a congressional correspondent, it was my primary job to cover the daily news. And the daily news as defined, not just at NPR, but at any good news organization, really, right now, is what's your government doing? What are they up to? What are they saying? And I understand that very much. It makes total sense, and I did it with great purpose for about a decade. But I think the last year, starting really with the debt ceiling debate about a year ago, I believe Congress has reached new, I guess we could call them depths of dysfunction.
New depths of lack of comity, depths of lack of seriousness,
well, you know, Bob,
responsibility.
One thing about Congress is that if no one is crossing to the other chamber to beat someone with a cane, it's not the worst it's ever been, right? It's always going to be a den of snakes and partisanship. That's part of the fun of covering it. It's part of what makes it interesting, the great train wreck of American ideas. But when it gets to the point where there is literally nothing in a day I can point to as genuine speech, then I have nothing to put on the air.
Your response is to leave NPR and start a blog to do more in-depth reporting, to choose your shots, to pull away from the chronicling of the political theater and try to get to issues and ideas. But you leave behind an entire congressional press corps. What should they do when they go to work tomorrow?
I think they should question their own definition of the day's news. I think they should question every other news organization's definition of the day's news. Unfortunately, it's very common still in the news business for editors to say to reporters, well, they have this story in Politico. Oh, they have this story in the New York Times. Oh, there's this story on CNN. Well, we've got to have that. And so it leaves the reporter chasing the soundbite that allows them to construct the story that their editor wants rather than the reporters who are there every day and know the theater saying, no, that's not really that big a deal. It may seem like it. It may be exciting, but that's not the truth of what's actually going on here.
Mr. Beal, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Bob.
Andrea Seabrook, not Howard Beal, has just left NPR to found Decode DC. What Andrea Seabrook says is all well and good, but you know who I feel sorry for? Politicians. It's just so hard for them nowadays to deliver their messages the way they want to. Look at Missouri Congressman Todd Akin, who's running for the Senate. Akin simply went to a local St. Louis Saturday interview show and let slip something maybe a little bit politically incorrect.
If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
And next thing you know, he was vilified coast to coast as some sort of woman-hating Bible thumper dispensing crackpot medical advice. Because evidently, when a tree falls in the forest, there's always someone lurking around to hear it. Back in the day, politicians were perfectly free to appear before chosen audiences to pronounce whatever they wished, knowing that the message would be self-contained. For instance, here's the late Yasser Arafat speaking in English to a Western audience.
Our people do not consider that exercising the right to self-determination could violate the rights of their neighbors or infringe on their security.
Meanwhile, on Palestinian TV, he promised viewers to lead them, man, woman, and child, to Jerusalem to be martyred. And he'd sacrifice 70 of his own people if it meant killing a single Israeli. Because, duh, it was in Arabic, and what was said in Gaza stayed in Gaza. Unfortunately, that party ended in 2006, when U.S. Senate candidate George Allen stopped his campaign bus in the hamlet of Brakes, Virginia, where he spied a cameraman from his opponent's campaign. The kid was a college student of South Asian descent, and next, Allen started talking about monkeys.
This fella here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere.
Turns out that recorded images are portable, something to do with YouTube or whatever. And within 24 hours, Allen's Senate campaign and 2008 presidential aspirations went poof. And since then, staying on message has just gotten harder. Take poor Michael Baumgartner. He's a Republican running for the U.S. Senate in Washington. His big issue is the war in Afghanistan. But in the wake of this week's controversy, one reporter kept pressing him for his views on abortion. So, what choice did Baumgartner have? He emailed the reporter, telling him, go f*** yourself. Attaboy, Mike. Really, the only other option is dog whistling, speaking to certain audiences in language that will be clear to the assembled, but obscure, or at least ambiguous, to nosy outsiders. This technique can give you a decent chance at targeting a message, but it requires mad skills. Here's Vice President Joe Biden before a largely black audience in Danville, Virginia, about 2 weeks ago.
They're going to put you all back in chains.
Although Biden seamlessly applied African-American dialect, some finger-pointers felt he was playing the slavery card. And why was he exposed to such criticism? Because even the Vice President of the United States can't appear before a large audience in the middle of a presidential campaign without someone eavesdropping. Politicians, poor guys, can't catch a break. At times like this, I just want to hug them. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Law enforcement agencies all over the country have been increasingly employing license plate readers, car-mounted cameras that scan the horizon with infrared to capture license plate numbers and the date, time, and location information of every car they pass in order to catch violators in real time. But just because you aren't a suspect doesn't mean that your whereabouts aren't being logged by these cameras, and it's likely happening nationwide. This week, U.S. border authorities revealed that their license plate reader data is shared with insurance companies. Eric Roper of the Minneapolis Star-Tribune, curious about his city's use of these devices, decided to perform a couple of Freedom of Information Act requests for license plate reader information. And he found that there was tons of location data just sitting there, available to anyone who asked for it.
What we found is that 4.9 million plates have been scanned in Minneapolis just in 2012. The vast amount of the data is on people who have not violated any laws but are just driving around the city.
The city is holding on to this data, which enables the police and, as it will turn out, third parties to know exactly where your car was within the city when.
You can make a request of what happens to be now public information. So the information on my car, which I requested, we received a number of data points that the police had kept over the course of a year about my whereabouts, but also the information of the mayor of Minneapolis. His information was also public. And within the past 21 days, that request came back with photos of the car because they store photos for 21 days. There isn't a state law, and this is the case in most states, governing how we keep this data, how long. So it's left up to local law enforcement agencies who can use it as they see fit.
Now, the principal use of this is to find people without standing warrants and stolen car reports and so forth. To your knowledge, have the police used the data in the aggregate to investigate an individual who they are interested in for perhaps something more significant than traffic fines?
The police have said that they do use what's stored in that database to help them with investigations. An example that they provided to me was they were looking for a suspect, and when they were trying to figure out where to begin, they looked at his license plate reader data and found that he was parked at a certain location repeatedly. That gave them a place to begin in trying to find him.
Hence the impulse to keep the data for a year instead of 2 days.
Exactly.
On this program, we are almost reflexively in favor of sunshine, that whatever the government's collecting, the public should have access to. But it frankly terrifies me that as a private citizen, I have access to essentially the tracking records of other private citizens.
Well, that's what's so ironic about this program is that it's not something that people generally know about. There hasn't been a lot of public discourse about the implementation of these readers. But here in Minnesota, that data is public. And now each state will depend on records requests there to find out whether the state open records laws preclude any of that. But you find that there's almost too much transparency when it comes to license plate data on a program that we haven't known much about up until now.
I mentioned the availability of this data to third parties. Now, that might mean a reporter interested in where the mayor's been, and it could be someone whose business has an interest in where your car is at any given time. You know of one such case.
Once we had published our first story about this, noting that this data is public with a data request, I came in to get the mayor's data for the next story. They pulled out a binder. Within that binder, there was one car dealership that sells cars to people with bad credit. Those people had stopped paying for those cars, and now it was trying to repossess those cars. So some repo men were looking for their cars and figured this was a perfect opportunity to do that.
Which is sort of funny, but what's troubling is there might be people even more sinister than repo men, people operating outside the law, who might have an interest in my driving patterns.
Right. And one of the most prominent voices on this, who is a chief information officer for our public defender service, he brought up the examples of ex-spouses and stalkers and people who are looking to burglarize people. I mean, he really feels like there are some major public safety implications here.
So which of On the Media's hobby horses should rise to the fore here? Should it be our sense that personal privacy is sacrosanct and that nobody should surrender it by accident, especially to the government? Or should it be that government transparency should be the overriding social good, and therefore if we surrender a little privacy in the bargain, it's no big deal? Or is there some middle ground here?
I think the first step here with regard to transparency is having a public discussion at legislatures, at city councils, at the federal government level perhaps, about this technology. And so that at least allows people to understand what's out there and how it's being used. From there, decisions can be made about whether it's private or public, how it can be shared, how police can use this to arrest people. You know, I think transparency starts with having a public discussion. And so that basically seems to be just beginning.
Eric, many thanks.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Eric Roper is a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. We have frequently discussed the problems of reporting the battle between rebels and government forces in Syria, chiefly getting into the country to witness the fighting. Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, the most watched Arab satellite news channels, have nonetheless covered the story heavily. But the question is, how well? Blogger and political commentator Sultan Al-Qasimi believes that both channels have played the story up big at the expense of basic journalistic standards, including excessive deference to the Gulf states that sponsor them.
Qatar established Al Jazeera in 1996. In 2003, weeks before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Al Jazeera's competition, Al Arabiya, was launched, mainly financed by Saudi, Lebanese, and other Gulf money.
Tell me what you see as being the most obvious and perhaps pernicious journalistic misbehavior.
For instance, Al Jazeera and Arabiya would host individuals who would speak for 15, 20 minutes about events on the ground. when they were not even in the country. Sometimes, even if they were in the country, they would be hundreds of miles away from the scene of events. The background of some of these activists is never investigated. The channels do not give disclaimers about them not being able to verify these videos or these claims. There is a pattern that we noticed with them being clearly sympathetic of the rebels. That is not the job of a channel that I'm supposed to turn to for neutral news.
Maybe the most astonishing example of what you've just described is the appearance, I think on both channels, of the cleric Adnan Al-Aror. He's presented as a kind of disinterested voice on the subject, but has said the most incendiary things about the Assad regime and the Alawite minority that supports him.
And their clamor to host anyone who will criticize the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad, the channels have gone to an unprecedented low by hosting a vile cleric who has said the most horrific things about a minority, a sect that is part and parcel of the community that is Syria. He's encouraging people to take revenge on them.
To quote, mince them in meat grinders and feed their flesh to the dogs.
Amongst other things.
At Al Jazeera, the guy running the Syrian desk is the brother of a leader in the Syrian National Council, which sounds innocuous enough, but it happens to be the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria.
Well, the SNC is a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated opposition group. An investigation by the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar found that these two individuals, one who works in Al Jazeera, who handles the Syrian desk, and one who is a senior member of the SNC, are in fact brothers, but they go by different last names in order to hide this affiliation. This also builds into a very strong relationship between Al Jazeera and the Muslim Brotherhood organization, not only in Syria, but also in Egypt and elsewhere.
We've till now discussed sins of commission. There are also sins of omission, you say, chiefly obscuring the fact that some members of the rebel forces are not necessarily good guys themselves. For example, some of them are Al-Qaeda.
There have been reports for over a year now that there are elements of extreme Sunni Islamist groups that have been operating in Syria. As the evidence mounts, these channels continue to dismiss it, perhaps only very briefly mention this quite alarming development.
If you're right about all of this, that the bias is clear and sinister, are Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya fighting a proxy war against Iran through their support of the Syrian opposition?
Well, the Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera are very much an extension of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the countries that back them. So whatever the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of their countries judge to be a worthy cause, these channels propagate that cause. I don't know if it is so much anti-Iran as it is trying to influence the outcome of one of the last Arab states that hasn't been deconstructed yet. And so Syria, with its strategic position, the makeup of the population, is a very important state. And so whoever emerges triumphantly from the outcome of this civil war could either be an ally of the Al Jazeera backers or the backers of Al Arabiya.
Now, to be clear here, finding fault with a pro-rebel slant at Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya does not equal defending the Bashar al-Assad regime.
This regime is evil. It has caused the deaths of 20,000 people at least. My sympathies lie with the people who want to see the end of this regime. However, I refuse to be sold a story that is in one way or the other curated for the benefit of one party or the other.
Sultan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Political commentator Sultan Al-Qasimi wrote about Syria coverage on foreignpolicy.com. Sultan Al-Qasimi believes Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya are so eager to support Syrian rebels that they're misrepresenting the reality on the ground. We asked Mazen Hayek, the official spokesman of the MBC group, which owns Al Arabiya, to respond to Qasimi's critique. Mazen, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob.
Let's begin with the basic premise that either out of zeal to criticize Bashar al-Assad and his regime or for the state interests of Saudi Arabia, Al Arabiya is throwing journalistic distance to the wind. Is it true?
Definitely not true. But Sultan Al-Qasimi is a renowned young Arab blogger and social media activist, followed by many peers. But in reality, he never worked as a professional journalist. Sultan Al-Qasimi hasn't picked up the phone and checked with Al Arabiya if what he's claiming is true. And without checking, he's practically doing what he's accusing us of doing.
Well, then, let me do what you say Al-Qasimi did not do and go down the bill of indictment point by point. Can we start with evidently the frequent appearance on your channel of the firebrand Sunni cleric Adnan Al-Aror? I wonder how he is deemed to be an honest broker of events on the ground.
Al-Arabiya is known to be a moderate news channel, is known to never promote radicals or extremists. In this case of this sheikh or another one, these are the available sources in a country that is close to us, where you don't have access, where you don't have reporters. So you're relying on phone commentators, whoever is available to comment.
One of the questions that's been asked about the rebellion is, what is its composition? How much of it is freedom fighters dedicated to overthrowing the regime of Bashar al-Assad? What percentage of it is criminal gangs exploiting the chaos for their own gain? What percentage of it is al-Qaeda? But one thing is clear. All of these components are present. And one of the charges by al-Qasimi is that al-Arabiya has suppressed any discussion of the al-Qaeda element within the anti-government forces.
It's not up to a news network to classify or to give percentages of the type of fighters.
Mazen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I simply could not disagree with you more. Of course it is the news organization's responsibility to report on the nature of the opposition.
Bob, you've asked me clearly for a percentage of al-Qaeda within Syrian Free Army. Who could give you those percentages?
I understand, but the charge he made is that al-Arabiya is suppressing any discussion of any al-Qaeda representation in the Free Syrian Army.
It's not true. I mean, every debate is open, and we're opening the channel for whoever is ready to talk about the conflict in Syria.
Did at any time al-Arabiya show user-generated video purporting to be taking place at one place in time when, in fact, it had taken place at a previous time in a different
location? In a conflict of a year and a half, 24 hours breaking news, tens of thousands of received material and footage, I tell you such material had not exceed the bar of a handful number of videos. And they were immediately withdrawn, and there was an apology or a mention that these were not accurate.
I think maybe his most serious charge is the allegation that al-Arabiya is acting not as an independent news organization, but as an instrument of the state of Saudi Arabia and of the interests of the Gulf states versus Syria and Iran. Al-Arabiya built up huge credibility covering the war in Iraq, in covering the Arab Spring. And the question is, has it squandered that credibility by lining up so directly behind the interests of the Gulf states?
No, it hasn't. Being Saudi-owned doesn't necessarily mean you're a foreign policy tool for Saudi Arabia. The accusations of al-Qasimi are simplistic. The same way they accuse U.S. media of being pro-U.S. administration by the mere fact of being American. We're Saudi-owned, yes, but that doesn't mean we suddenly become a foreign policy tool.
There's no way for me to verify, because I do not understand Arabic, at the source whether his charges have any merit. But I do know this, that in the midst of the Arab Spring, when the uprising began in Bahrain, al-Arabiya did not cover them to anywhere near the degree that it covered them in Egypt, in Libya, in Tunisia. And the assumption, not just in my studios, but around the world, was that your Saudi and Gulf owners wanted no part of giving oxygen to those protests.
as far as Bahrain is concerned. We've covered the Bahrain, not in a distorted, exaggerated manner. Remember, incidents in Bahrain happened when our crews were in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya. Libya was at the peak of it. Which is a priority for you on that month? I'm just asking you, you're the editor-in-chief of On Duty. And you have your resources, and you're deploying them, and you want to cover everything every time, 24 hours. It's been 2 years and a half now of 24-hour coverage.
Mazen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Mazen Hayek is the official spokesman for the MBC Group, which owns Al Arabiya. We contacted Al Jazeera, and it gave us a written statement saying in part that, quote, just like news channels in the U.S., Al Jazeera Arabic is also accused by people with specific religious and political views for not reflecting them 100%. Our job is to report news from the ground in an in-depth, balanced manner, which we do very successfully. Coming up, an On the Media producer goes to Libya to look into the role the media played in a revolution. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. 1 year ago this week, Libyan rebels took control of the capital city, Tripoli, ending the 42-year rule of Muammar Gaddafi. When the Libyan uprising first began in February of last year, OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman took a holiday from straight journalism and became involved with something called Feb 17 Voices, a Twitter feed intended to keep information flowing out of Libya in case of a media blackout. Last month, she went to Libya to witness its election and to meet the people behind the voices.
The Feb 17 Voices feed involved contacting people in Libya and recording their eyewitness accounts.
We were alarmed when we were met with live ammunition in the street.
Their stories were difficult to hear.
They killed a woman who were outside her doorsteps screaming for her son. She wanted him to come home. They shot her down.
And we couldn't do anything but listen.
They're shooting at us something real ugly. Call me back. I'll give you all the details.
That last message was left on a Google Voice account by my husband's cousin, Usama. Like me, my husband Abdullah is the child of a dissident, and out of fear of endangering family back home, had never spoken to many of his relatives, including Usama. Now, suddenly, a connection, a deep one.
If we could get our hands on weapons, Abdullah, I swear to God we will get rid of this dog. You're my uncle's son. I have never laid eyes on you. This is the first time I ever spoken to you. I swear to God, Abdullah, I swear to God, since I was a little kid, I dreamed that I would be able to talk to you. I used to be afraid to even have thoughts about talking to you.
The February 17th revolution brought people together in ways we couldn't imagine. When the situation was desperate, we used the internet and social media to get information out. But ultimately, we used it the way people do every day, to connect. I'm finally in Tripoli, on my way to meet one of my regular contacts during the revolution, Hisham Bouhajar, who participated in last year's protests. Here's how he sounded then.
We saw the cars coming with a lot of soldiers. They started shooting immediately. I saw two people were shot, one of them in the head, was 2 meters away from me. I saw even one machine gun that's mounted over a truck, which used to fight aircraft. That was used against the demonstrators.
Our connection was made through my father, who Hisham had contacted shortly before the uprising began.
I told him, listen, in a few days we will start something, maybe it will end up in a big revolution, and can you help? We were thinking about a peaceful demonstration, and we will get the security by the media coverage, because if the media sees who we are, Gaddafi cannot hurt us. That's what we thought at that time.
How did you know in advance of February 17th to expect something?
Through Facebook. I saw a lot of talking. People were outspoken, and the talk was louder and louder. I was confident something is going to happen.
Hisham never used his real name with me. He knew the regime was watching, so he sent videos and updates with fake Facebook and Skype accounts.
If you know a little bit about the communication equipment and the surveillance in Libya, you can work safely. Through our own satellite station, you can send and receive information to the internet. We don't open it all the time. You know how I used to do it. I only open like for 1 hour, do my work, and then shut it down.
Hisham was able to protect his communications, but not himself. On February 25th, he helped organize a peaceful demonstration after Friday prayer. He decided to talk to the police outside the mosque first.
I'm talking to the police in a nice, soft voice, and their reaction was astonishing. They took the shotgun and immediately they shot at me. I was really shocked.
I called you right after you got shot. You were apologizing to me, saying, Sara, I'm sorry, I can't really talk right now, I just got shot, but I'll call you later.
Yeah, that was also a hard day.
I remember hanging up with you and saying, I can't believe he's apologizing to me, he just got shot.
Yeah, I thought part of our war against Gaddafi was a media war, so I thought I'm doing my job. And it got to the point where I can't do it anymore because I was shot.
Hisham fled the scene with 11 bullets in his leg, but he couldn't risk a trip to the hospital.
Because if they see the wounds, of course they will arrest me, and most probably they will kill me. Yeah? And this is what happened to a lot of people.
Hisham needed surgery, so he hopped the last commercial flight out of Tripoli, ending up in Belgium. That's when I finally learned who he was. Not a stranger, practically an uncle. He sent me a photo.
It was a picture of you in Seattle in probably 1985 at a picnic, and you were holding me, and I was 1 or 2 years old. And that's when I first knew who you were.
Oh, you're the daughter of my friend, and I feel like you're my family. And I thought, okay, I should give you some confidence of knowing who I am.
Surgeons were only able to remove some of the bullets in his leg, and Hisham anxiously returned to Libya. He says he couldn't stand by and watch as the regime's propaganda machine tried to convince the world that nothing was happening in Tripoli.
We had to do something to show that Tripoli was against Gaddafi, to use the media like Gaddafi is using it.
Early one morning, Hisham and nearly 36 others gathered at a well-known landmark in Tripoli. They blocked the streets with their cars, covered their faces, and filmed themselves holding up anti-government banners, while a spokesperson read a statement.
We said that Tripoli is not with Gaddafi, and we are not afraid of you. Okay, you are much powerful now, but you have to understand Tripoli will be like a burning stone under your feet.
Hisham says videos like that one broke the fear barrier, and protesters around the city began making symbolic gestures to show the world and one another that they were still around.
Symbolic things like, okay, the falling flag. You take a flag, dip it in water, put it in the freezer, and then at night we put it over a bridge. When the ice melts, and the flag drops immediately.
So that there's nobody there when the flag actually falls.
Of course, if they see you doing the flag, you're gone. Eh? Balloons, the hot air balloons also with the flag. It was distracting for the government so much. I saw one time when the balloon came with the flag, maybe 1,000 bullets went to that balloon, I mean, just to try to get it down. For us, it was an energizing thing to do.
Eventually, Hisham and many others took up arms, and along with NATO, defeated the regime. He also got shot in the legs a few more times. Today, Hisham has returned to a mostly civilian life, running his carpet and restaurant businesses. And as more exiles return to Libya, Hisham continues to make connections, reuniting with old friends.
We have a meeting that we do every Wednesday in the restaurant. Every time we bring somebody, it's usually I didn't see for 25 years, 30 years. And it's really amazing, really amazing. It's totally different feeling.
Covering the revolution on social media brought me together with someone from my past. For Ahmed Adarat, monitoring the revolution on social media led him to a complete stranger who would change his life.
I grew up in a Libyan exile community in Lexington, Kentucky. And all the people that I was around, they're all passionate about returning home to a free Libya. That passion really rubbed off on me.
I've known Ahmed all my life. I also happen to be married to his cousin. In 2009, Ahmed and my husband Abdullah founded Enough Gaddafi, a group of second-generation Libyan exiles trying to draw attention to the atrocities of the Gaddafi regime.
Gaddafi and his son Saif were kind of starting to get a little comfortable with the West. Saif even tried to reach out to young Libyan Americans such as myself. to basically jump on his bandwagon. You know, hey, come on this trip. Basically trying to buy them.
I'm Rahma Jibani. I was one of those that was sucked up in the bribes they had for us, who actually were invited out for free to come visit Libya for the summer.
Rahma Jibani was raised in California and went to Libya on a regime-sponsored trip in 2010, after which her family decided to move there. A year later, she watched with anticipation as the Arab Spring began in Tunis and spread to Egypt. When Rahma started seeing rumblings calling for a Libyan Day of Rage, February 17th, she created an image in support of the event and posted it on Facebook.
I was like, yay, we're finally next in line. It's our turn now.
So this girl named Rahma, I saw her post this February 17th graphic that she made, you know, come out, protest. And then I found out she was in Tripoli. And I was like, what is she doing? So I messaged her. I was like, what are you doing right now? You're in Tripoli and you're doing stuff like this.
After that meeting on Facebook, they decided to stay in touch. And a few days later, Rahma, with her father and brother, joined an anti-government protest in Tripoli. She called Ahmed.
And she's all excited. Oh my God, we're protesting. There's like 300, 500 people here. That was the first time that she called me, the first time we actually spoke on the phone. I hung up, I was like, oh my God, this is freaking awesome.
And sooner or later, all I see is the SWAT team shooting. Everyone just disperses. And a guy comes to me and he's like, you run. So I just started running. And that's when I called Ahmed.
She's like, out of breath. She's like, oh my God, they started shooting. Oh my God.
As she was running away, Rahma let us record her for the Voices feed.
They just brought us up. We were about 300 people. And the cops came and they started shooting gunfire at us. We were trying to get escape.
Rahma continued to give regular updates to Ahmed, to Feb 17 Voices, and to the international media.
Well, Rahma is a Libyan activist. She joins us now on the line from the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Rahma, thanks for speaking to Al Jazeera.
In the Green Square, there's been riots. There are sniper shooters on the rooftops, ready to shoot anybody who does any suspicious movement.
I just felt like, you know, I need to do something on my part. I had CNN, I had Al Jazeera International, I had BBC. They would literally call me all day. Later, we started hearing that people were getting taken in because they were calling news media.
At that time, I was like, man, this girl, she's got some guts, man. That was that first spark of attraction. She would give me regular updates as to what was going on. Every time she would hear the NATO strikes, she'd be like, yeah, I heard at least 10 or 20 strikes, one after another. But after that, these strikes started to become a regular thing. So it just started to become, hey, I'm checking up on you. And then it would turn into a regular conversation.
I was like, oh, who's this guy checking up on me and caring? And once in a while, he would call me sweetie and I would get like butterflies in my stomach. And I'm like, oh my God, he called me sweetie.
The conflict wore on for months and they grew closer every day. Rahma was careful, talking only in secret and swapping SIM cards in her cell phone. But Gaddafi forces confiscated her phone after seeing her use it to film a long line for gasoline, a common sight those days because of the fuel shortages. She thought she was safe. Just the week before, water had damaged her old phone, and her new one had no contact numbers and no incriminating messages. But she didn't know that one of her cousins, with her face covered, had taken a picture of herself in front of the revolutionary flag using Rahma's phone. When the soldiers saw the photo, they pointed a Kalashnikov rifle at Rahma and her 14-year-old sister, all the way to the detainment center.
The whole time I was like panicking. I looked at my sister and she's wearing the same exact jacket as the girl in the picture. So I told my sister, I was like, oh, I'm really cold, give me your jacket. And I was holding her hand tight and I told her, I love you. And we just started praying.
After hours of questioning, Rahma was able to convince her interrogators that she wasn't the girl in the picture. She and her sister were released, but her family decided it was time to leave. They eventually made their way to the eastern Libyan city of Benghazi, which Gaddafi forces had lost early on in the uprising. In the months that followed, Gaddafi was killed, and Ahmed went to Libya for the first time in his life.
And I had like this out-of-body experience. I couldn't believe it. I was looking around. I was like, I'm in Libya. I'm in Libya right now. It was like a dream.
July 1st, 2012, we got married.
July 1st, we had our wedding ceremony.
guys going to talk about now? Your courtship happened during a revolution. A revolution that nobody imagined would ever actually happen in Libya. I mean, you're talking about groceries now? Like, life's going to seem so boring now.
I'm going to call him and be like, yeah, there was like 5 airstrikes. You know, just to heat things up.
Ahmed and Rahma's wedding also marked a symbolic end to exile for many of the guests, who traveled from everywhere to attend. The party was epic, but an even bigger celebration was coming. It's election day in Libya. I'm standing in the middle of Martyrs Square, formerly Green Square. That honking that you're hearing is the melody of a chant that people here have been singing during the revolution, and it goes, "Arfa rasak fog, anta ribi hur," and that means, raise your head up, you're a free Libyan. And so all over the city today, people have been honking that melody as part of the celebration and the festivities. Now for me, this story isn't about media anymore. It's not about people connecting online, on Facebook or on Twitter. It started there, but it ends here, with people connecting to their homeland. Specifically my dad, who after more than 30 years in exile, was finally able to return to Libya last year. I've barely been able to see him during this trip, because since November, he's been serving as the country's Minister of Higher Education. But Election Day is a national holiday, so we're sharing a rare moment together. He's taking me to see his old elementary school.
Which was the only elementary school in this part of the city.
Did you guys do your homework on stone tablets?
No, actually it was much more advanced then than now. We had much better classrooms and we even had school buses. We don't have any of that now. And there used to be a church here in this corner of the school. And a post office on this corner. And that's the school.
How do you still remember where everything is? It's been more than 3 decades.
Don't forget these things.
Today's election marks the first time since 1965 that Libyans have been able to vote. And on this day, 3 generations of my family went together to see democracy in action. My grandfather says he's been waiting for this day his whole life, that he finally feels pride for his country. And my normally cranky grandmother, I've never seen her as happy as when she talks about voting today. And my aunt snapping her photo as she dropped the ballot into the box.
So I see my mom coming out of the area right now. She's waving her ink-stained finger. How was it?
I felt I did something right for my first time in this place here. So I'm so excited. And I feel I want to jump and do things like a little girl. So excited. So happy. I want to cry too.
Okay, and now my dad just came out. He's wiping his finger. So how was it?
That's good. These are very special times for Libya and Libyans, of course, to be able to vote for the first time after so many years. People paid very high price for this moment.
I can feel the people who are not with us now. That's painful. And I wish they're with us, or they can see or they can feel what they start. And inshallah, we're gonna be fine.
The Election Day celebrations went on into the early morning. And this month, Libya saw its first peaceful transition of power when the National Transitional Council passed the baton to the newly elected General Assembly. Libya is collectively healing from months of war and decades of oppression. Institutions are being built from scratch. A phrase I frequently hear is Libya hurra, or Libya is free, often just used to justify doing whatever you want. And most Libyans here have no real memory of what freedom is. But maybe, as my father said about his old school, you don't forget these things. For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdurrahman.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Bernie Bernstein. with more help from Ariel Stuhlberg and Lita Martinez, and edited by Jamie York and me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.